You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Following pro-Trump rioters storming the Capitol last week, many are calling for Trump's impeachment. I interviewed Dr. Neil Curtis, an associate professor in media and communication at the University of Auckland, about the factors that reinforce white supremacy and entitlement in Trump's social media ban. We started the interview discussing what has led to the state of current democracy in the United States.
What probably kicked this all off, although it's got a very, very long history, I think what triggered all of this was the first black president. I think once President Obama was elected, I think that sent a signal to the right in America, and particularly the hard or far right in America, that their world had been turned upside down, something that they'd worried about for a very long time, probably since the abolition of slavery, in fact. And so I think in response to Obama's election, you then had a very strong and sort of vociferous response from the right, and in particular from white America. So I think that's how we got to this current situation. That's part of it. I suppose the second aspect would be the gradual move of the GOP, the Republican Party, from a sort of more traditional form of conservatism to a more radical type that was probably signalled by the rise of the Tea Party. Much of what went on there was a sort of groundwork for the alt-right and Trumpism. So there was that shift in the GOP, which then, once it sort of flowered into Trump, and sort of Trump became this person that would do anything, really, prepared to do anything to further the cause of the wealthy and the right, and particularly those who were against abortion and stuff. I think they went all in with him. The GOP effectively became a Trump cult at that point. You can see that now, even after the sort of attempted coup or the insurrection or sedition, whatever you want to call it, they're still, you know, trying to defend him and saying, no, don't impeach, don't get rid of him under the 25th and all this sort of stuff. So and I think the fact that people like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley were so central to what happened the other day is indicative of where the GOP is. And of course, I believe there was even the wife of a Supreme Court justice who was involved in the sort of assault on Congress, which is just extraordinary if you sort of think that through. Those are the two kind of broad causes, I would say, the sort of two tributaries that got us to this point.
And what factors then continue to affirm white supremacy and entitlement?
Well, I think there's clearly a massive problem with the police. I mean, we saw how when there was a BLM protest in Washington, Trump called out the National Guard and you couldn't get anywhere near Congress, which was a complete overreaction to what was largely a peaceful protest. By the way, I think you'll find out, CNN just released figures that somewhere in the region of 330 people were arrested at that march, whereas only 65 people have so far been arrested from the assault on Congress. We also saw, so the National Guard protected it when the BLM protesters were there, but we actually saw the opposite. We actually saw police opening barriers to let them in and even ushering them down corridors, right? So this is clearly a problem where the police, there's a bias in the police towards upholding the law for certain types of people and not for others, or who believe certain people require a different form of more summary justice than other people. So that's a major problem. The other thing is just the way that the sort of corporate oligarchy has taken over US democracy. I mean, it's always been the case since 1961. President Eisenhower, when he left office, warned of the military-industrial complex taking over US democracy, so that's a president warning about it. That's been a long-standing problem, and of course that's just been exacerbated by the Citizens United legislation, which allows even more money to come into Congress and determine the politics. So you've got a sort of a problem with the police, you've got an increasingly radicalized right wing that has this sort of a president, and some of them referred to as the sort of God Emperor Trump. You've got massive amounts of money controlling politics. You've got voter suppression. That's the other way in which white supremacy has continued, right? You look at what was going on in Georgia, even when Stacey Abrams lost, the amount of people that were purged from registers, the way in which voting in certain counties was made extremely difficult by not having enough polling stations, and then within those stations, not enough polling booths. I mean, there's a great book by Carol Anderson called White Rage, which I think everybody should read, because it's such an eye-opener about the ways in which white Americans have tried to counter any advance, whether it's social, political, or economic, by black or African Americans. And it starts all the way back with the abolition of slavery, 1865. That was the same year when the Ku Klux Klan was founded, right? So you can see how white people saw the change to their world and how they created this organization to try and counter that change. And it's continued, right, in mild and quite extreme forms throughout that period of time, and it continues today. So that's the way that sort of white supremacy maintains itself continually.
And clearly the treatment of those who stormed the Capitol to Black Lives Matter protesters was starkly different. Yeah. Can this all be blamed on Trump?
But it's very important to understand that Trump is not the cause of this. Trump is a symptom and potentially an accelerant or a trigger. You can think of him as like a medium, right? He channels this stuff. But the source and the cause lies somewhere else, and where it lies is racism, white supremacy, and then coupled with this sort of corporate control of US democracy, right? So I don't think we're going to see the end of it. In fact, the opposite. I mean, people like Josh Hawley as well something needs to happen to him, because he was clearly lining himself up as Trump's inheritor. You know, he was going to go off in a sort of face-off with Ted Cruz, and he was the sort of young, high-flying lawyer. I think he's a lawyer, possibly from Harvard. And he was going to be the new face of this movement that started with the most recently, I suppose, started with the Tea Party and then turned into Trumpism. So all the problems that exist, all the resentment and the rage still exists, the racism still exists, the inequality still exists, the precarity in people's lives still exists. I mean, I've just written a book about this, which is out in March. All of that stuff that contributes to resentment and that makes far-right charismatic politics seductive, none of that's going to change in the immediate term, not in the UK, not in the US, not across Europe, you know. So it needs to be dealt with quite significantly, I think, or else people are going to realise that they can do it and get away with it, and next time there'll be people who aren't as stupid as Trump, or so sort of obviously just a kind of gangster and a kleptocrat, and that I think they'll be more successful if the US Congress doesn't clamp down on this in a serious way.
And what has the role of social media been in spreading disinformation and radicalizing extremists?
Well, you also need to remember traditional media as well. I mean, Rupert Murdoch's Fox News has played a very important role in this, so we shouldn't forget how significant Rupert Murdoch has been in this period of time. But yes, social media has been very important. Facebook in particular is a, interestingly they call it social media, but it's a profoundly anti-social media as well. I saw something the other day talking about one of Facebook's own pieces of research where a report showed that 64% of people who joined radical political groups were actually directed to them by Facebook itself. And Facebook has done absolutely nothing to prevent this and everything to advance it, right? I mean, even when Steve Bannon on his War Room podcast was calling for Dr. Fauci to be beheaded and his head put on a pike outside of Congress or the White House, even then Zuckerberg came out and said this does not contravene our policies. So, I mean, they've given him a temporary suspension now. Zuckerberg's done that, and the sort of rather pathetic Nick Clegg, who used to be the leader of the Labour Party in the UK, he's now working for Facebook. He came out and presented the temporary suspension. But, you know, they've done so much damage here that it's really quite extraordinary. Twitter, of course, hasn't helped. And, I mean, places like Parlay, I think Apple have just taken Parlay off the App Store, and it's an app-based platform, so it doesn't have a website as such. But Parlay, people on Parlay are planning what's called Million Martyr March for the 20th, which is when Trump leaves office. So God knows what's going to happen on the 20th. Maybe enough organisation has been done already to coordinate that, but... yes, I think we do need some kind of regulation of social media. We still need people exchanging opposite views. I mean, in my work, I've learnt a great deal from conservative philosophers, and I don't in any way regard myself as conservative. So I think we need kinds of debates. But I think when people are encouraging very targeted discrimination and encouraging violence, then this stuff really does need to be stamped out, because it's troubling.
Yeah, is it sort of too late now to be banning Trump? Has the damage already been done? Should this have been done much earlier?
Yes, well, I mean, the problem with banning Trump is a very difficult thing to do because, you know, although the First Amendment only protects people from government censorship, right? The First Amendment secures free speech in a way that the government can't censor you, right? It doesn't say anything about private companies. It doesn't say that, you know, a privately owned building has to hold a meeting for fascists if the fascist wants to hold a meeting there. The owners can say, no, I'm not going to let that happen. And a publisher can say, no, I'm not going to publish this work. And likewise, social media, a private company, can say, no, I'm not going to, you know, platform this material. But I think the problem comes when you've actually got the President of the United States, and therefore it is very much part of the public discourse, you see. I think it's a much more grey area, but I don't think we've got the legislation. I say we haven't... I don't think the US has either got the proper kind of legislation to actually deal with these kinds of grey areas. I might be wrong on that and someone might correct me, but I think the law, as it does in so many cases, the law lags behind technology. You know, we seem to be able to technologically advance much faster than we can sort of morally, if you like, and it's often moral thought that underpins developments in law. So I think we're lagging behind in terms of legislating in relation to this, but it becomes a problem. I think, you know, maybe not shutting down Trump himself, but certainly shutting down a lot of the other people who were sort of Trump supporters that were clearly sort of promoting discriminatory and sort of violent language, that might have been a possibility. But then there needs to be some form of regulation of these companies. But you see, we're already at the position now where Facebook is such a huge company that it almost becomes impossible to touch it, and that's the danger. I suppose the sort of capitalist system as it exists, where we have a situation where private companies can become so big and so powerful that they actually end up being beyond any possible accountability by any national government, because you just literally can't touch them because they're so huge, and often because you're actually dependent upon them yourself. So, I mean, that's an even bigger discussion about how we maintain democracy within a capitalist system that's creating companies that have so much money they could start a small war if they wanted to, right? They have a bigger GDP than many countries. How do we even bring those back within some kind of democratic oversight, right? That's an even bigger question, structural question. But I mean, all of this just tells you that we're in a bit of a mess on lots of fronts, and it's troubling. But the only other point I'd make is that it sort of goes back to the question of white supremacy, and I think if you look at the laws in place in the Constitution in terms of the US and how it protects itself in times of emergency, it's really interesting that what's known as the emergency principle came about in a Supreme Court ruling in 1969, I believe. And what this ruling did was it quashed a charge against a white supremacist who had been publishing some really kind of, I think, quite sort of violent and hostile material about Jews and African Americans. Obviously, they weren't using that term back in those days. And he was calling for sort of violent action, and he'd been charged and found guilty of incitement to violence. And when this Supreme Court ruling came out, it actually overturned that ruling and said that they didn't actually present an immediate threat. Now, what had happened at the same time in that Supreme Court ruling was they upheld an earlier charge against a member of the American Communist Party who they declared was an immediate threat simply because he was talking about alternative politics. And I think this is something that's really, really important, because it suggests to me — I'm no constitutional expert, so I'm happy to be challenged or corrected on this — but it seems to me that there's a blind spot within the US judiciary and the US legal system where it just can't see white supremacy as a threat, because white supremacy nearly always advocates for a very naked form of capitalism that is very central to American life. So that always appears as less of a threat than people who are arguing for an alternative social and economic system, whether that is communism or whether it's socialism or whether it's even just social democracy. And I think that's a real blind spot, and that should trouble all Americans, that the legal system, the Constitution, the Supreme Court can't quite see white supremacy is a threat. And we've seen that again with Trump taking funding away from research and monitoring of white supremacist groups. We see it again in the contrast of the policing between the BLM march in Washington and this Stop the Steal march in Washington, you know. So we see this, what I call in the book, this emergency bias. We see it, and we see it within the judicial system, and whether America can actually finally open its eyes is another big question. And what will play out over the next week in America will show us whether they can see this or not.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.